From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm a West Coast boy in for vacationing Terry Gross, and on this edition of Fresh Air, three different views of the Big Apple. Journalist Isidore Barmash covers the retail business world in New York City, one of the toughest battlegrounds on earth. Barmash's new book, Macy's for Sale, examines the famed department store's recent leveraged buyout and the merger mania that pervades corporate America and costs us all while a few get very rich. Also today, we talk with writer Mark Singer. His biographies in the New Yorker magazine profile New York's great and unknown. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the album New York. It's the latest effort from veteran rocker Lou Reed. That and more coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. My guest today is Isidore Barmash, who's reported on retailing issues over the past 20 years. He's currently at the New York Times. In 1985 and 86, he covered the leveraged buyout of Macy's department store by a group of their executives. He chronicles the personal and financial maneuverings in his new book called Macy's for Sale. Now, you may not think a mega-million-dollar leveraged buyout has much to do with you, but if you go into a store that's gone through this financial metamorphosis to buy a tie, say, the silk may not be as fine or it might cost you more just to help pay for the deal. Though customers may suffer from a corporate takeover, there are some who profit. In the Macy's buyout, someone holding, say, 400 shares of Macy's common stock worth about $17,000 would have made about $8,000 on the buyout. But an executive of the company could expect his same $17,000 investment to bring him $1.5 million in a few years when the stock goes public again. I ask Isidore Barmash if a leveraged buyout was a bit like overextending yourself on a huge home mortgage and then paying off the crushing extra burden of debt by selling off a couple of your kids.
Well, a leveraged buyout is a technique where the people who buy a company, usually the management portion of the investing group, puts up very little money, somewhere on the order of 10 to 20%, to buy a company, and they get banks and insurance companies and other big investors to foot the rest of the bill. In a regular merger, much more money is put up front. The difference then is that in a leveraged buyout, there's much more debt and involving junk bonds, which can take as much as 10, 15 years to pay back. So the risk is much greater for the investors than in a regular merger. Plus the fact that in an LBO, there's the really ironical element in that the assets and cash flow of the company being bought are used to cement the merger. Whereas in a regular merger, that's true to a certain extent, but it's less of a burden because much more money is put up front, therefore there's less debt.
What drives a hostile takeover? Why is it called what is the function of a hostile takeover?
Well, a hostile takeover means that some outside company decides to make a play for a company which they deem to have greater value in its assets than the current market share would show. For example, when Robert Campo, the Canadian entrepreneur, decided to take over Federated Department Stores, which includes Bloomingdale's and A&S and Burdine's and so on, he offered at first a very low bid of about $48 a share. Eventually, because there was resistance, wound up paying $73.50 a share. But he knew that the company was worth a lot more. In a lot of companies, you see, there's hidden assets because a lot of the assets are put and kept on the books at a low historical value, whereas later on, and one of the features of LBOs is to divest what they do buy and pay up debt and make money out of the divestitures, you can get a lot more when you start putting properties on the market than you are carrying them on the books. That's the same situation with Macy's. Macy's paid $68 a share, the management group, and the stock was selling in the 40s at the time they proposed the deal, which was in October of 1985. They realized that there was much more implicit value in the company if it would later be expanded or parts of it sold off. And so there's always that reason of exploiting what is a hidden asset, which would have much greater value later.
A hidden asset being, for instance, a piece of property on which a store is resting in a mall?
Right. That's exactly a good example. Sometimes a company will carry a shopping center or a store in a shopping center at a fairly low value in its balance sheet, partly to pay low because they want to pay lower taxes. But if they decide to sell it, they're certainly going to ask for a lot more than they're carrying that property on the books. Usually, it's about 25 to 35% more value than is shown on their books.
What is the force that goes on in a hostile takeover that says that says a company has to accept the offer that comes in? Why can't a company just sort of ignore the phone calls and say, sorry, we aren't interested? I mean, what is the is there any compulsion for a company to respond to a hostile takeover effort?
Yes, there is. The main reason to respond is that the offer is usually well above the current market share, which means that the management of the company and the directors have to consider any offer in the light of benefiting the shareholders.
So this is an obligation then?
Yeah, and in past cases, going back 10 years, for example, where a company didn't respond, they were and the hostile investor walked away without getting the company, management was sued by a bunch of shareholders in class action suits alleging that the directors had not operated for the benefit of those shareholders. And there are lots of lawyers out there in all the cities who are looking to class action suits because they generally are settled out of court at a very high fee. And that they, of course, like that. So there's that ever-present threat that if I want to buy your company and you don't respond, your shareholders are going to sue the hell out of me later.
Ironically, because of a takeover, it's often the of a leveraged buyout. It's often the shareholders who are hurt the most, though.
That's the irony of it. And there are a lot of shareholders who are unhappy about it. You can say, well, they got $20 a share or $30 a share more than the stock was worth at the time. But the fact is that not everybody wants to have a one-shot cash-in. They want to keep the shares. It's an extra form of security.
Plus, it'll pay the dividends, and then they'll have to pay taxes on what comes in.
And the stock can always rise in value.
And, of course, it seems the scale of profit that can be made is much higher for those on the inside of a leveraged buyout. For instance, in your example at Macy's, a $70,000 investment by one of the 350 of the management group decided to be in could net them, after a few years, $3.5 to $4 million. Or a $17,000 investment, $1.5 million. I mean, that seems like a far better return than a shareholder would ever see for similar amounts.
No question about it. The Macy Buying Group only put in $17.5 million to reap an eventual $200 million plus.
What kind of workload do people have once they take on all this enormous amount of debt, say, in the Macy's buyout?
They work like hell. They put in longer hours, weekends, nights. The whole emphasis of their job changes from planning new strategy, bringing in new merchandise, to doing everything they can to enhance profit. And it's usually done by cutting expenses. You can have a 5% increase in sales, but if you cut your expenses, 10 and 15%, i.e. by lopping off people, lopping off sales clerks, cutting down on various services, your sales can produce a heck of a bigger profit.
So it seems that the focus of doing business after one of these leveraged buyouts changes from, say, selling shirts and coats and ties to that of purely paying off your debt.
Right. A lot of times, too, it causes the management, the buyout group, to take their eye off the ball, and competition closes in on them. And increasingly, there's been a great criticism of these LBO companies. Macy's, for example, has had a very rough year. They don't give out very much, but they have had considerable problems with their many private labels. Customers seem to be becoming less enthralled with store labels, but more going back more to national brands because these brands have more credibility. Private label goods, unfortunately, are very expensive. And that's another thing that happens. These stores increase their markups as they, in other words, raise prices as they pursue the payoff of debt. And that hurts their business because customers are pretty sharp today. They know what a shirt should cost or a dress or a scarf.
I was startled to see that one of the ways that the Macy's buyout was financed was through an insurance company that apparently knew the management wanted the money badly enough so that they're now making a 28% return on their money, plus charging an override on every single sale made.
Yeah, that kind of shocked me when I found out about it. I think it's really one of the most revealing things of all about this Macy for sale business, in that everybody who got involved was making an exorbitant, getting an exorbitant return. And that was as much for the individual as it was for the big company. But that was a good example I was glad to find out about, and it's very authentic. I got it from inside the company, the insurance company.
Well, next time my insurance rates go up, I'll think about that.
Good luck.
My guest is Isidore Barmash. He writes about retail business for The New York Times, and he has a new book called The Leveraged Buyout of the World's Largest Store, Macy's, for sale. What are the moral issues that you see raised in this? We see a lot in the press about people such as Ivan Boesky being sent off to the slammer, Drexel Burnham Lambert, a brokerage house that's dealt a lot in junk bonds, being chased by the Racketeering Act. What's happening to American business? Is there just so much money flowing and so many people trying to get their fingers on it that?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of money available from Wall Street and the banks and insurance companies and pension funds. This kind of money is being dangled at lots of interesting possible buyouts. You ask about moral issues. There's a very simple moral issue in which I get into in my book, and that is that I raise the question of whether a chief executive officer who was extremely well paid and his top team who are extremely well paid have the right with one hand to operate the company and with the other hand to plan, to take it over. You can't wear two hats. If you are attacked and you see a possibility of benefiting the stockholder by making a better offer or getting a white knight to make a better offer, that's one thing. But in a case where the LBO is self-starting in terms of the management, seems to me that the CEO has not been playing it straight. He's been planning to take over a company that's treated him very well and for which there was no threat and no need. Now, there is another issue here, too, which is just as important and maybe more far-reaching. All these companies that have gotten involved in LBOs, and Macy's is a good example, have suddenly found that the enormous debt that they've taken on was tougher to pay than they thought. And so their activities have been diverted more to being to pay that debt then they have been directed at operating a good company, and it's been a big diversion or distraction of attention away from the real job to the job of paying off your debt. So the question again is, what is the value of an LBO to society? And more, you're hearing in Congress, and you're hearing it from businessmen, mergers and their special form, the LBOs, do not really help. Those who advocate them say, well, a company that's strong won't be taken over. On the other hand, while there are examples of strong companies being taken over, mergers do not really help a gross national product. They don't result in giving customers better prices. They do result in less employment because in every merger, there is a reduction of force, sometimes amounting to as much as 25%. And there doesn't seem to be any social or economic benefit to American society. And that's a very big moral issue. I think eventually the government is going to have to step in and do something on junk bonds, something which, of course, would affect the incidence of LBOs. And more, there's a great disaffection with this sort of thing.
What do these CEOs and other financial people see when you come around to ask them questions, raise some of these issues? How do they treat you as a member of the press?
Well, with great carefulness and wariness. I've been a business writer all my life, and it's no easier now to get information. In fact, I think it's tougher because you have more government scrutiny. You have all the insider trading scandals. They treat me as a sort of a friendly adversary, in some cases as an unfriendly adversary. I don't ever accept the fact that these people are my good friends. Because one thing I've learned is that, unfortunately, they are a good friend until you write something a little bit nasty. And then suddenly you find a total change in their behavior toward you. But generally, I would say there's a growing adversary relationship between business and the media. And it's natural, I guess. There's more to hide. And there's more risk in speaking out. And that's why the media has to be more aggressive and more investigative. And it's not an easy role.
Well, I was struck by the comment that Ross Johnson made, who was involved in the insider takeover bit of RJ Nabisco, who said that, who many people assumed that he was going to earn $1 billion from his LBO. And people thought that there were only going to be seven people who were going to benefit. And he said, hey, look, if I knew that this was all going to be in the newspapers, I'd have said there are going to be 15,000 people. It's like these people almost need public embarrassment in order to get some sort of even keel back on how they're running a business.
That's very true. There's an awful lot that goes on that is not exposed. I think the press and all the media have to be much more militant about it and much more probing. On the other hand, in my work at the New York Times, I'm a repository of a lot of rumors and sometimes from anonymous sources, and I find that a lot of them are simply sour grapes and somebody trying to get another guy in trouble. And you have to check everything out. And most of what I hear I don't print because I find there's no confirmation, no real substance to it. So you have to tread that fine line. You've got to be aggressive, but you also have to be very careful. And it is true that business would prefer not to have unfavorable news exposed. It affects their stock. It affects their reputation. But I think more and more, as the SEC gets tough, they are obligated and are revealing more negative stuff. But not nearly enough.
My guest is Isidore Barmash. He writes about retail business for the New York Times. His new book about the leveraged buyout of Macy's is titled Macy's for Sale. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Isidore Barmash. He has a new book on the leveraged buyout of Macy's and also talks about the phenomenon of leveraged buyouts in general in this country. One of the issues that you raise in your book is about loyalty. The main character that you follow through is the president of Macy's, Ed Finkelstein. And one of the qualities that he looks for in his employees is intense personal loyalty to himself. And he feels betrayed if anyone that he's helped out resigns the company, goes off and works at another organization. Yet the whole leveraged buyout issue seems to raise significant issues of loyalty, like where is loyalty? It almost makes loyalty a commodity, because it seems that the ultimate loyalty that anybody has, after all, then, is going to be to the dollar in these deals.
Well, I think if there's one thing that has emerged from this big merger wave of the last 5 years, and there's been a previous one in the 70s, is the fact that there is there are increasing reasons not to be loyal to your employer. And that's very unfortunate, because the quality of loyalty is tantamount to motivation. But as companies are bought and sold, as pieces of it are sold off, as people lose their jobs after many years, the feeling grows that you cannot rely on the employer, that the employer will do what is right for the company rather than for you. The employer will do what's right for the employer. And as I say, I think that's very unfortunate, because it does affect how people perform, and it does affect how long they stay. As you know, in Japan, it's the reverse. People stay on a job all their lives, and they simply don't understand why we move around from job to job.
You've been covering these issues for such a long time, a couple of decades. Do you see these leverage buyouts as an aberration, a potential footnote to business history, or is it the end of civilization as we know it?
Oh, no, I think it's an aberration. Mm-hmm. I think that the country is going through a massive recycling of its assets. Companies that have been around a long time are being cut into pieces through acquisition. I think LBOs will finally be clamped down on by the government. I think that junk bonds is going, the whole insider trading thing has hurt the credibility of mergers anyway. And I think there'll be some new, I think we'll always have mergers. It's just been part of our history. It comes in fits and starts, but I think the LBO, by its own nature and its controversial methods, will eventually be knocked out, and some new form will take over, something a little bit more legitimate, perhaps. And but mergers will always be with us.
Where do you think the rebellion will come from in changing these practices? Will it come from the public, outraged at how much money people are making in these deals, sometimes as much as $200 million a year in bonuses for certain individuals, seeing people like Ivan Boesky sent to the slammer? Or will it be through Congress, or will it be eventually from banks who decide they don't trust the financial arrangements anymore?
I think it'll come from all those directions. It'll come from public disaffection. Congress is talking more and more about this. And I think it'll come from disenchanted large investors who are very antsy anyway when they see a leveraged buyout delaying payment and sales and earnings not doing so well. Look, they have shareholders too. So I think you have all these forces working together. Don't forget, too, that under the Reagan administration, there's been a very lax enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which could be brought into play much more as it used to be. So now you have a new president, you have a Democratic Congress. I think you're going to see some real action, and I can't predict that it's going to happen next week, but I think you're going to see a lot of discussion about the morality of these mergers and the risks of junk bonds and high corporate debt. And it is, if it doesn't add anything, it's very difficult to substantiate the benefits of all these mergers and make sense. I mean, you can proselytize, mm-hmm. but everybody will know what it is. It's just a lot of hype.
Your background has been in covering retail business for the New York Times for many years. How did you first become interested in the retail trade?
Well, you know, it's the old story. What determines a career? It's more or less an accident. I studied journalism, and after I came out of the Army in World War II, I looked for a job, and it was very difficult. And the first decent job I was offered was with Fairchild Publications, which publishes Women's Wear Daily, in their Philadelphia bureau, and I joined it, and I've been covering this field all the way as both a writer and an editor for many years. Look, I probably would have preferred to cover sports or politics or foreign affairs, but I must say, in all honesty, that I think it's a very interesting field. It's constantly changing. There are some very interesting people and new people coming up. It's a high-speed track, and every day and every week is a new ball game, and that's really my story.
When you walk into a store to buy a tie, are you able just to do that, or do you always keep your eye out for what's going on, how the cash registers are working, how the clerks are treating you, how the design of the store looks?
You know, you're hitting me where it hurts. I hate to shop. I hate to shop.
You do.
My wife is a great shopper and really knows how to beat the system by shopping so well. I can't stand shopping because I'm very impatient. I feel closed in. When I go into a store, I'm sort of caught between wanting to buy a tie or a pair of socks or a jacket and looking around to see what kind of operation it is. I suppose it's like a railroad guy who or an airline guy who may not like to fly, but loves to talk about it and write about it and see what's happening.
Well, Isidore Barmash, thanks for coming in and talking with us today about the retail business and the leveraged buyouts. Isidore Barmash's new book is Macy's for Sale, The Leveraged Buyout of the World's Largest Store. It's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Barmash writes about business for the New York Times. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with landscape architect Lawrence Halprin. He designs public spaces such as Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco and Sea Ranch on the California coast. He's part urban planner, part artist, part ecologist. He sees his work as choreographing people's behavior in space. I hope you can join us.
I've gotten down to my last pair of shoes. Can't even win a nickel bet. Because of them that's got, of them that gets, and I ain't got nothing yet. I'm sneaking in and out, ducking my landlord. All I seem to do is stay in debt. Because of them that's got, yeah, of them that gets, and I tell y'all, I ain't got nothing yet. That old saying, them that's got or them that gets, is something I can't see. If you gotta have something before you can get something, how do you get your first is still a mystery to me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on holiday. I'm using her chair for a few days. You may remember that old TV show that began with the line about a million stories in the naked city. Well, in real life, Mark Singer tells some of those stories through his profile pieces and Talk of the Town features in the New Yorker magazine. Coming up, Mark Singer talks about the lives of theater moguls, street performers, and stove repairmen. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Lou Reed. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of the new British movie, The Dressmaker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Communist Party leaders in Poland made it official today, unveiling a resolution allowing the formation of new labor unions. The plan could clear the way for the re-legalization of the outlawed Solidarity trade union. In Gdańsk, Jane Dobia reports on Solidarity's first response to the proposal.
At his weekly press conference, union leader Lech Wałęsa sidestepped a confrontation with party leaders over conditions that still might be attached to Solidarity's legalization. Earlier this week, the Polish Prime Minister suggested union leaders might have to refrain from strikes, divorce themselves from anti-communist groups, and refuse financial aid from foreign governments if they want to be allowed back into the official labor movement. Instead, Wałęsa defended Solidarity's independence and said union members would not permit limitations on their freedom. In general, Solidarity leaders in Gdańsk today seem cautious but positive about the Communist Party resolution. One union leader commented that the latest party plenum broke new ground by presenting the re-legalization of Solidarity as a subject that is open to discussion. Wałęsa promised a fuller statement on the Communist Party resolution after the conditions for Solidarity's reactivation have been made clear. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Gdańsk.
The Soviet Union announced a new step today in its de-escalation process. Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze said his country will remove some tactical nuclear weapons from Eastern Europe as it withdraws some 250,000 troops. Shevardnadze also promised data on numbers of troops and armaments of the Warsaw Pact by the end of the month. In response, the White House said the U.S. welcomes any Soviet military reductions, but will wait to determine the impact of today's announcement. More than 150 traders, brokers, and commodity executives may be indicted in a fraud and racketeering scandal reportedly under investigation by the FBI. The probe of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the Chicago Board of Trade is reported to rival the insider trading scandal that shook Wall Street last year. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
According to unidentified sources in this morning's Chicago Tribune, undercover FBI agents, posing as floor traders at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, secretly tape-recorded hundreds of conversations among brokers, floor traders, and commodity firm executives. The tapes indicate that more than 100 people in the exchanges systematically violated the rules for their own gain, and sources close to the investigation told the newspaper that investors may have been defrauded of millions of dollars. Denials that there even is an investigation issued from all the parties said to be involved. The U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI in Chicago declined comment, and callers to the Chicago Board of Trade today were advised to consult their attorneys for further information. The Tribune story apparently had an effect on the world's two largest futures exchanges. The price of a seat on the Board of Trade today reportedly dropped by $35,000 after trading opened. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Budget Director-designate Richard Darman told Congress today that he would recommend a tax increase if it were necessary. But at his Senate confirmation hearing today, Darman said he thinks the budget deficit can be brought under control without raising taxes. He said in deciding whether to recommend new taxes, he would consider the economic impact as well as the effect such a choice would have on the president's credibility. One day before leaving office, President Reagan today lifted the ban on U.S. oil companies doing business with Libya. Mr. Reagan said he had to do it to protect U.S. interests. Five American oil companies were ordered by the Reagan administration 3 years ago to sign contracts with Libya, which provided for a suspension of operations to protect the firms from charges of default on their obligations to Libya's state-owned oil company. Stock prices rose fractionally today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 0.54 to close at 2239.29. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 60s, Lou Reed was a founding member of the influential cult band The Velvet Underground, and he wrote hardcore streetwise songs like Heroin, White Light, White Heat, and Waiting for the Man. Since 1970, when the band split up, Reed's had a solo career. His latest album is called New York. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
You can't depend on your family. You can't depend on your friends. You can't depend on a beginning. You can't depend on an end. You can't depend on intelligence. You can't depend on God. You can only depend on one thing. You need a busload of faith to get by. Watch it, baby.
Lou Reed has a good line he's frequently repeated when asked about the group that brought him fame. He says that the Velvet Underground never sold many albums, but that every person who bought one started a rock band. It's a one-liner that encapsulates a profound pop truth. Lou Reed either wrote or co-wrote a lot of the Velvet Underground's best songs, and his jaded yet poetic sensibility gave the music a cynical edge that rarely gave way to cheap despair. On his own, as a solo artist, Reed's career has been much more erratic, but scarcely less intriguing. So when a fellow as intelligent and important to rock history as Lou Reed says that he's just released his best album ever, you would do well to pay close attention to it. And if, after listening to it, you decide that the album is woefully uneven, sometimes wonderful and sometimes an embarrassment, you'd better figure out why.
There's blacks with knives and whites with clubs, fighting at Howard Beach. There's no such thing as human rights when you walk the New York streets. A cop was shot in the head by a 10-year-old kid named Boot in Central Park last week. The fathers and daughters lined up by the coffins by the statue of bigotry. Hey, you better hold on. Something happening here. You better hold on. Well, I'll meet you at Tompkins Square. The dopey sent a message to the cops last week and they shot him in the car where he sat. And Eleanor Bumpus and Michael Stewart must have appreciated that. There's a rampaging rage rising up like a plague of bloody vials washing up on the beach. It'll take more than the angels or I and Mike Tyson to heal this bloody bridge. Hey, hey, you better hold on.
This new album called New York is a series of rock and roll weather reports, bulletins from a Lower East Side rocker in his 40s with the talent and nerve to think that his complaints about his old neighborhood can be made into good music. But the song I just played, called Hold On, is a strong argument against that proposition. It's a self-righteous drag, full of topical references to things like the Tompkins Square Park riot and the police murder of a black woman named Eleanor Bumpers that aren't going to mean much to people outside of New York, and which don't have enough artistic power to transcend their use as political metaphors. This is an album by a man made angry by what he reads in the papers, and as such, it's a much more idealistic, even naive record than this self-styled tough guy has ever recorded.
We who have so much, to you who have so little, to you who don't have anything at all. We who have so much, more than any one man does need, and you who don't have anything at all.
That Straw Man, which features some good guitar playing by Mike Rathke and Reed himself, as well as a slightly more potent, generalized lyric. It's easy to hear why Lou Reed thinks this is his best album. It's obviously his most sincere and earnest effort, but artists can't be trusted to know their own best work, and New York contains a few real howlers, like this one.
They say he didn't have an enemy. His was a greatness to behold. He was the last surviving progeny, the last one on this side of the world. He measured a half mile from tip to tail, silver and black, with powerful fins. They say he could split a mountain in two. That's how he got the Grand Canyon. Last great American whale. Last great American whale.
I've listened to that song a half dozen times and I still start to snicker when he gets to that chorus. I still can't believe that Lou Reed is now writing sappy hymns to the whales in all apparent sincerity. Very quickly, let me erase the memory of that tripe from your mind by playing a bit of an excellent song on this album, one in which his social conscience coincides with solid musical instincts. It's called There Is No Time.
This is no time to swallow anger.
This is no time to ignore hate. This is no time to be acting frivolous, because the time is getting late. This is no time for private vendettas. This is no time to not know who you are. Self-knowledge is a dangerous thing, the freedom of who you are. This is no time to ignore warnings. This is no time to clear the plate. Let's not be sorry after the fact, and let the past become our fate. There is no time. There is no time.
There, that was better, wasn't it? The most fascinating thing about this new album is that Reed can make terrific, ferocious music like that, and then follow it up with a song like Good Evening, Mr. Waldheim, a truly bizarre effort that equates Kurt Waldheim with the Pope and Jesse Jackson, all of whom Lou Reed finds guilty of the same crimes against humanity. None of the crimes are really spelled out, but he keeps repeating, "There's no common ground enough for me and you." Here and elsewhere, Reed ends up sounding less like a passionate poet than a neoconservative crank. This is the sort of prolix, almost baffling album that makes me wish that the critic who understood Lou Reed best, the late Lester Bangs, was still around to make full sense of it. Maybe like Elvis, Lester could come back from the grave and write a review.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Good evening, Mr. Waldheim and Ponta, how are you? You have so much in common in the things you do. Here comes Jesse Jackson. He talks of common ground. Does that common ground include me? Or is it just a sound that shakes? Oh, Jesse, you must watch the sounds you make.
This is Fresh Air. Maybe it takes someone not from New York to truly appreciate the mix of characters and sounds that inhabit that uninhibited city. Mark Singer was a young man from Oklahoma when he became a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. The editor, Mr. Sean, assigned him to write Talk of the Town pieces. Those are the short, unsigned sketches appearing in the front of the magazine that rely on the voices of New York. Singer's collected some of those Talk of the Town pieces along with longer profiles in a new book called Mr. Personality. One of his profiles took us to lunch with the powerful motion picture and theatrical talent agent, Sam Cohn.
Physically, he is an odd combination. One often hears Cohn described as a fat fellow, but the characterization is inaccurate. Rather, he is an almost spindly man who, for the time being, out of a healthy affection for rich food and drink, elects to wear a larger person's midriff. His face has a squarish cast, and it also has dimples. There is a considerable gap between his front teeth. He has lank auburn hair that has now mostly gone gray. Despite this, he does not look his age, which is 52. He has a thin, crinkled mouth, a pink complexion, and blue eyes that can't see very far. Behind his eyeglasses, thick lenses in translucent, flesh-toned frames, he squints. The squint gives him a look that is a mixture of curiosity and amusement. If Cohn were less nearsighted, he could see the same expression on the faces of many people who know him well and are anticipating his next move.
That's a wonderfully honed description of Sam Cohn. Did it take you long to work that up? Did these images just come right into your mind, the image of a spindly fellow who elects to wear a large person's midriff?
I think those images probably come in uninvited, but it certainly isn't something that happens automatically. In other words, I would, as close to as possible, live with these subjects of mine. Certainly the longer pieces, I wouldn't move in with them literally, but I spend months and months in their company, in and out. Cohn was very accommodating that way, everyone has to be if they're going to be subjected to a New Yorker profile anyway.
How do you avoid from going over, if you spend several months following somebody around, watching their life, sitting in on their most private conversations, how do you maintain your writer's distance without sort of verging over into friendship or joining them in their jokes or offering advice?
Well, it's a very good question, and the answer is that you don't. You in fact, have a two-way street. You're invading their space, their privacy, and they have a right to know something about you. So while these don't become your closest friends, they do become friends. It's inevitable. And I suppose that means that I wouldn't end up writing a profile about someone for whom I had great contempt. At the same time, there's a distance that always has to exist, because ultimately I go to my little room and write, and then they're going to pick it up and read it in the magazine someday. The odd thing that I think happens in these circumstances is that you often end up protecting the subject from himself. People reveal a great deal. People like to... I've come to the conclusion that people like to be exposed. What you sometimes have to do is cover them up a little bit.
The profile pieces are about 10 times as long as the Talk of the Town pieces, which seem to be about 900 to 1,200 words. And you found wedding ring salesmen, stove repairmen, a zipper salesman. How do you find these people? Does somebody tip you off at a party and say, Mark or Mr. Singer, this is just the very guy you want to go after and do a little feature on?
They happen in every possible way. The stove repairman came to repair my stove. He walked into my kitchen. That was how I found him. The zipper man, someone told me about. And I actually think the wedding ring salesman I heard about because someone had heard about him on, of all things, a National Public Radio broadcast. And then things happen serendipitously.
I've always seen the Talk of the Town as some sort of a great anonymous chalkboard where just about anybody can come up and write something amusing or poignant or politically barbed. Does the anonymity attract you, or are you sort of breaking out from an anonymous pattern by publishing this book of anonymous pieces?
Well, that... I treasure that anonymity, and so then that makes me sound like a hypocrite to have then put my name on a book that has some talk pieces. But these are 25 pieces out of maybe 250 that I've written over the years, and of talk pieces. And I just feel that it's a great gift. I like to be able to walk out in the city as a reporter and not as a person who's going to get in the way of the story because he has a recognizable byline.
Does your voice as a writer change when you write a profile piece that'll be signed then?
That's a very good question. I'd like to think at this point, no, that I've been at this for a while now and that my style is my style. But certainly when I started out as a Talk of the Town reporter in 1974. I was just 24 years old.
Which actually, in truth, sounds like every writer's fantasy job.
It was a good way to discover New York. I finally, about a year ago, had lunch with William Shawn, who had hired me, who left the New Yorker in 1987, and I basically had to satisfy my curiosity as to why I was hired. I was 2 years out of college, and I had never wanted to be a journalist, and wound up in New York and at the New Yorker. And Mr. Shawn hired me on what seemed to me virtually no evidence that I could do what I then was asked to do. And as it turned out, when I asked him why I was hired, he didn't have a very specific answer. He operated on instinct, and I'm very grateful for that. So I came to New York and started writing these pieces, and then not long after I'd been writing Talk of the Town pieces, I decided to write a profile, which is in this book, a profile of Goodman Ace. I was able to include myself in the piece, in the first person singular, occasionally, where it was convenient. And
In part because there was a distant relationship there by marriage?
Right, an odd relationship. Mm-hmm. My Goodman Ace was at one time thought known as the dean of television comedy writers, but he really became celebrated during the 1930s, long before television. In the 30s and 40s, he was the writer, director, star, along with his wife, Jane, of a radio program called Easy Aces. And Goodman Ace's sister married my grandfather, so while we were technically not blood related, he was my great uncle, and we were very close.
I have to tell you, in rereading your Goodman Ace profile, I realized it was you who gave me the basis of a story that I enjoy telling at restaurants, which is about the gendarme. There appears to be a holdup in the kitchen.
Right.
I mean, I'm abbreviating the joke, but...
Well, we've told the punchline, but basically the waiter comes over after the patron says, "Gendarme, gendarme," and the waiter comes over and says, "Excuse me, sir, I believe you mean garçon. Gendarme is the French word for policeman." And he says, "That's exactly who I want. There seems to be some holdup in the kitchen." I use that all the time. I've never called a waiter anything but gendarme, and much to my wife's dismay, I might add.
One of the hallmarks of Talk of the Town pieces, and I think especially yours, is that there's an ending, not quite a kicker, but there's always a nice ending that wraps up, ties up together everything that's gone on before without it necessarily seeming like an abrupt the end. It tends to be a quotation from the stove repairman or the wedding ring salesman that kind of leaves you with a little smile on your face and like, weren't we fortunate to drop in and see this person? When do you hear that? Do you know at the time when you hear somebody say... like the wedding ring salesman trying to pitch a wedding ring. Okay, then, if you know any other fellows as foolish as you, send them to me.
Right.
Does that just sort of leap out to you as a closing sentence?
It usually does. And, of course, they don't always happen at the end of the interview. You know those lines when you hear them. Sometimes, of course, you hear more than one. And you say to yourself, how am I going to end the piece with this? I'd like to end it with that, and they're both great lines. But it's amazing how regularly there is one perfect ending.
All right, Mark Singer, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
My pleasure.
Mark Singer's profiles and Talk of the Town pieces from The New Yorker are collected in his new book, Mr. Personality, published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later today on National Public Radio is All Things Considered, and host Robert Siegel will, I think, describe how they're going to be covering a party, the food, the furniture.
Well, certainly we'll be discussing the Reagan years. You know, Alex Chadwick has been collecting people's reminiscences of what the past 8 years have been to them, what the Reagan years have been all about. And tonight we present them. For a third of our program. We will also, on the subject of furniture, we will be explaining what the world's largest chair, my source being the Guinness Book of World Records, is doing in Washington, D.C. this week on Constitution Avenue.
A comprehensive show as usual. Thank you, Robert. All Things Considered, coming up later here on National Public Radio. The Dressmaker is a new movie from England that magnifies small events. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
I've often poo-pooed the widely held belief that Americans can't make the kind of small-scale, intimate films Europeans make. We may not have any Truffauts or Chabrols, but we have our own kind of intimate filmmaking. We have Jonathan Demme making Melvin and Howard. We have Joyce Chopra making Smooth Talk. We have, for better or for worse, Lawrence Kasdan making The Accidental Tourist. Actually, though, we don't have anyone who can turn out a film like the new British release, The Dressmaker. The director, Jim O'Brien, is well known in England for his TV work, principally on The Jewel and the Crown. But The Dressmaker doesn't feel like TV at all. In fact, the world it creates is almost too intimate and deeply textured for TV. The details here are crucial, and the small screen hasn't the fineness of grain to capture them. Watching the people in The Dressmaker is like looking at something very tiny, through a microscope whose powers are so great that at a certain point one simply passes through the placid surface and finds oneself inside where the fires rage. The setting is Liverpool in 1944. And on the outside, the spinster seamstress Nellie is all propriety and poise. On the inside, however, she's a demon of repression. And Joan Plowright's performance equips the audience with that microscope. She shows you the outside and then, gradually, the seething inside. Nellie rules her strange little family with an iron hand. There's her 17-year-old niece, Rita, played by Jane Horrocks. There's Rita's maladroit father, a butcher who can't stand the sight of blood. And there's Nellie's wild sister, Margot, a widow still avid for a good time. Adapting a novel by Beryl Bainbridge, the screenwriter John McGrath sets the elements in place like so many powerful magnets. Then he lets us watch the tensions and currents that pass among them. Liverpool is full of American soldiers, and shy, awkward young Rita falls in love with one of them, a southern galoot named Wesley. For Rita, having a boyfriend becomes a kind of idée fixe, almost a religion.
I can't sleep. Is it that fella? Now be brave. Your Wesley was round here. That day I was off sick.
Eh?
He wanted me to break it to you gently.
What? What do you mean?
Well, he wants to do what's best. He feels you're too young. He's a nice lad.
No!
Oh, don't take it to heart.
He's gonna ring me.
No, love. He's not.
That's Billy Whitlaw as Margot, breaking the news to her niece. What Rita doesn't know is that Wesley has come to Auntie Margot not just to break up with Rita, but in hopes that Margot will offer him the sexual favors that Rita is terrified to give. Watching the dressmaker is like sitting in a room and becoming gradually aware of an ominous ticking underneath your seat. As the tensions between repression and desire build, something has got to explode. Yet, even the movie's horrific climax has an oddly placid, intimate tone. The whole movie has a deadpan knowingness that makes its humor and its horror paradoxically more effective. It's true that Americans can't make movies like this one, and that may be partly because we don't have actors like Plowright and Whitlaw, actors who can take plain, small-scale characters and, for 90 minutes, make them fill the world.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. The Dressmaker is currently playing in New York and opens in Los Angeles, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and Boston over the next few weeks. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I speak with West Coast novelist Don Carpenter. His latest book, From a Distant Place, examines a family slowly coming to grips with its own disillusionment in affluent Marin County. Also, critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Shimmer, a new work by performance artist John O'Keefe. O'Keefe is a San Francisco playwright, director, and singer who illuminates his violent childhood spent in orphanages and juvenile homes throughout the Midwest. And in our weekly performance segment, pianist Mac Rebenack will be back. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.